Okay, good evening. My name is Jürgen Hake. I'm a faculty member of the International Relations Department, and I'm also the director of the Sourcewear Hawk Southeast Asia Center here at the London School of Economics. I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to all of you. Thank you for taking such a keen interest in the LSE's public lecture program, and particularly, obviously, this event, which is on armed groups, state, and society in Myanmar. Tonight's panel discussion is jointly hosted by the Global South Unit of the International Relations Department and the Sourcewear Hawk Southeast Asia Center. As you may know, the Global South Unit is located within the International Relations Department, and the Southeast Asia Center is one of the regional centers that is operating under the umbrella of the school's Institute of Global Affairs. As far as the Global South Unit is concerned, today's event builds on a previous workshop that was organized in 2015 on Myanmar's borderlands. And SEAC has obviously organized various other discussions already on Myanmar. I think in March we had, for example, a panel which looked at the NLD-led government 1 year in. We hope to be able to continue these events on Myanmar, and it's really wonderful to see so many of you interested in this country. Now, before I get to introductions of our speakers, let me just say one or two more things. First of all, I want to acknowledge to those other people who are involved in planning this event that I have to sort of say my thanks to two persons in particular who had a role in getting this together. One is Matthew Wilton, who is based at Oxford University, and David Brenner, who sits at the far end of this panel. They played a really important role in making today's panel discussion possible. And secondly, I know that many of you may be agitated by the recent security operations, or clearance operations, so-called, in Rakhine State, and the exodus of literally hundreds of thousands of people to Bangladesh. But the speakers we have brought here tonight won't really be looking at what is going on in Rakhine State, at least certainly not in their short presentations. Instead, the focus for tonight is much more generally on the ethnic conflict and the role that armed groups, if you like, ethnic armed organizations have been playing. And as you will be aware, Myanmar is a country that has been afflicted by ethnic conflict since the dawn of independence, if not before. Even now, there are multiple armed groups that are involved in insurgencies, particularly in Shan and Kachin State. This means that in geographical terms, the focus for tonight is really on the northern and northeastern borderlands of Myanmar, and as I said, not on Rakhine State. We have five speakers, as you can see, and we will start with an overview of the dilemmas Myanmar is facing in terms of the ethnic conflict and the reform process underway. We will then zoom in with two speakers on armed groups and their responses to the state, and then a further two panelists will be looking at the role of armed groups in relation to the society in which they are embedded. Now, I'm going to keep the introductions pretty short, but let me welcome, first of all, Martin Smith, who, as you know, is the author of the classic Burma Insurgency and the Politics of Ethnicity. He's currently a trustee of the Prospect Burma Education Trust and a senior advisor to the Transnational Institute. Our second speaker will be John Buchanan, who is the Director of Communications at the Institute for Strategy and Policy, Myanmar. And he recently completed a PhD on the social and economic foundations of strongman authority at the University of Washington in Seattle. Third, in line will be Patrick Meehan, who is a Global Challenges Research Fund postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Development Studies at SOAS. Patrick's work concentrates on the political economy of drugs and violence surrounding processes of state building and economic development in Myanmar's frontier regions, with a primary focus on Myanmar's borderlands with China and Thailand. Fourth, we have Jatoy Pan, who is an associate director of the Kachin Land research center in Michener. She is currently actually based at LSE as the holder of Achieving Award, and she's studying here for an MSc in Social Anthropology. Welcome. And finally, we have David Brenner, who is a lecturer in international relations at the Department of Politics in the at the University of Surrey. He is also an associate fellow at the LSE Global South Unit. And David has been interested in the social underpinnings and dynamics of insurgency and political violence in Myanmar. Now, I'm extremely happy to have such a fantastic panel here, but I do wish to say that the participants are speaking in their personal capacity. Yeah, so their views, as expressed here tonight, do not necessarily reflect those of the Southeast Asia Center or the Global South Unit or indeed the LSE. Also, please note that some of the speakers would be more comfortable if this event was held under Chatham House rules, and we are going to do that. This means that points and arguments made are for you to engage with, but that you may not then later attribute them to any particular individual, either explicitly or implicitly. Without any further ado, I'd like to invite Martin, please, to kick us off. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, it's often said that the first thing that colonial rule denies a people is their history. And I think certainly in Burma, contemporary Myanmar, this experience has been especially acute. It was administered until 1937 as a province of the British India Empire. And it can be argued that even today, as we're seeing with the crises around the border world, the peoples of this country are yet to agree on identities and the political reforms of the modern-day state. And I think this is relevant because neighbouring countries, other parts of Asia, have long since moved on with these things. But I would say that in Myanmar, the challenges of post-colonial transition underpin the country remaining one of the most conflict-divided states in Asia. And the political and humanitarian consequences, as we're going to hear tonight, have been immense. The social and political affairs of the country are highly militarized. This is not only in government, where the National Armed Forces, known as the Tatmadaw, have been in control, state control, pretty much for half a century, but it's also in the case of ethnic politics, which we'll be talking about this evening. And hopes have recently been raised by the advent of government of the National League for Democracy last year. But I think it's important to stress that there haven't been any moments of major breakthrough change. Just to give an idea of the complexity at present, there are 21 ethnic armed organisations recognised by the government. Some of these have ceasefires and some do not. The ones without ceasefires have the asterisks next to them. But beyond this, as some of the other speakers will be highlighting, there are dozens of militias backed by the Tatmadaw as well as border guard forces. And they are all part of this very, very complex conflict landscape. And then meanwhile, around the country's different borders, there's over 1 million refugees and displaced people. And their numbers have lately been increasing. Most recently, as you've been hearing, in the northern Rakhine state, where many Muslims have been leaving who identify as Rohingya. I'd have to say that the unfortunate thing is international opinion often only wakes up to the scale of this crisis when there's new headlines. This year it's Arakan, last year was Koh Kang, the year before Kachin, and before that Karen, and so on. But I would argue that the way to look at this is rather than seeing each crisis as exceptional or peripheral, each of these crises lie, these ethnic challenge crises, lie at the heart of the failures of the modern day state. And as evidence of this, a few statistics. Myanmar currently stands at 145 out of 188 countries on the UN Human Development Index. And this is one of the most rich countries in Asia in terms of natural resources, human resources. It's also the eighth largest refugee-producing country in the world, according to the UNHCR. It's the second largest producer of illicit opium after Afghanistan. And all of these factors underpin this state of social crisis, humanitarian emergency, and state underachievement. To put this in context, I think it's important to stress that it can only be Myanmar's people who can solve their problems and find peaceful change. And in a recent TNI report, it was highlighted how, if you start from the Panglong Agreement in 1947 and go through to the present, there have been continuing peace and reform initiatives. It's not been for the want of trying, including under parliamentary democracy in the 50s and under military government after 62. Most recently, as you can see at the bottom, they're continuing with the NLD, which has instituted a 21st century Panglong Peace Conference. Now, it's a highly symbolic move because it actually goes back to the origins of why the Union of Burma was formed, which was as a union of equal peoples. That was the Panglong Agreement. But instead, as violence broke out of the country at independence, a unitary system was developed and later imposed. This became explicit with Ne Win's military coup in 1962, and that was in response to a federal movement in 1961 when the ethnic parties tried to resolve the state of crisis by introducing a federal constitution. And since this time, the Tatmadaw have essentially remained in control of national government. In their view, they've been saving the country. In the view of their opponents, they've become the central problem themselves. Turning to the present, a lot of change over the last 5 years since President Thein Sein's quasi-civilian government took office in 2011, and I think it's very important to acknowledge this. The country is much more open, much more liberalised as a result. And the changes are most evident in Yangon and the main conurbations, but also in some of the borderlands where new agricultural programmes can be started. And along with the increased energy in civil society, I think this change has been helped by two things. First of all, parliamentary politics, and secondly, a new ethnic peace process. And in the two ways, these different processes combined with the NLD winning the election, taking government office last year, and also with a partial nationwide ceasefire agreement in October 2015, just before Thein Sein steps down. Well, so far, so good. But over the past 2 years, this peace process has begun to stall, and it's important to say that the parliamentary reform and peace processes have yet to be brought on the same track. And there are many reasons behind this, with different sides passing the blame, but I'd say in structural terms, two issues first stand out. First of all, the NLD has yet to show if and how it will amend the 2008 constitution, which allows considerable rights to the National Armed Forces. And the second is that for the moment, the Tatmadaw is yet to allow all the ethnic armed organizations into the peace process. And indeed, during a time of supposed peace building, conflict has actually spread in the country, with ethnic groups accusing the authorities of playing divide and rule. And for a while, the Kachin and Northern Shan states were once promoted as model zones of peace. Today, they become conflict zones. And areas, Shan and Karen areas in the southeast of the country, which were formerly conflict zones, are enjoying their first ceasefires in many decades. And so this is a really unhelpful paradigm. In some areas, conflict has started in the Kachin state. That was a ceasefire ceremony. It's now in conflict. And that's a Karen zone on the left, which is now at peace. To try and break the deadlock, the NLD has introduced this 21st century Panglong meeting. Two meetings have been held so far. And although there's widespread agreement on the need for federal reform, there are no inclusive agreements so far. Only eight of the armed groups, those on the left, have signed the NCA, and the remaining groups on the right are seeking further political change. And in a significant escalation, a number of these groups have recently formed a new federal negotiation committee amongst the Hua, Kachin, Shan, Ta'ang, Kokang groups on the China border. And they actually are much stronger in strength and influence than the groups who have signed. So the stage is very delicately set. There are hopes that a nationwide ceasefire agreement will eventually be achieved, and then dialogue can begin, real political dialogue, about the challenges facing the country. But it will not be easy, because concerns persist that there are powerful business and military stakeholders who are opposed to meaningful reform, and at the same time, as you'll have been hearing, there is a rising Buddhist nationalism in the country. And many minority groups think this is going to be problematical for state devolution and the enjoyment of real ethnic minority rights. And ethnic grievances have lately been growing up, not only due to conflict, but due to land grabbing and also natural resource exploitation. And so how much longer this state of neither war nor peace will continue is very uncertain. And the international community has been very alarmed by the recent Arakan crisis and the outpouring of refugees into Bangladesh. Certainly, the NLD's legacy in government is now going to be judged on how they deal with these two promises of political reform and ethnic peace. And just to quickly throw in, I think China could well become very important in this because it's placed Myanmar right in the strategic position in its Belt and Road Initiative to link China westwards through by land and sea to Eurasia and Africa. And it's recently been China, rather than the United Nations, which has been the most influential or innovative in being involved in the peace process in the country. And these two pictures actually highlight that. On the left are Kokang troops, and as you can see from the writing behind them, they are Chinese speakers. And on the right are Muslims in Arakan, who are regarded by the government as Bengalis and therefore from Bangladesh. So this relates back to my comment about post-colonial issues not being resolved. So I've taken a lot of shortcuts, cover a lot of bases here and finish here. The other speakers were getting more deeply. But I want to reiterate that hopes for national peace and reconciliation are not lost. And under a democratically elected government, it should be a better landscape for change than under the decades of military rule and conflict which preceded. But for reforms to be meaningful, this is going to need the principles of equality and union that were agreed at independence in 1948 have to be returned to. And what this means is a political endgame has to evolve in the coming months, not more of this conflict as a way of life, which has held the country back for so long. The warnings from history are very clear.
Thank you very much, Martin. And now we'll have Patrick.
Okay, as we've already talked about in the earlier presentations, Myanmar has one of the longest-running insurgencies in the world. And yet the political transition since 2010, and especially since Aung San Suu Kyi's election and taking over of the government, had led to huge hopes of a resolution to the country's conflict. And yet, alongside this hope, there's also been very significant problems and escalations of violent conflict throughout Myanmar. There is the breakdown of the 17-year ceasefire with the Kachin Independence Army. There's been widespread military offensives throughout parts of Burma's borderlands. There's been ongoing accounts of continued human rights abuses. There's been renewed conflict in areas of northern Shan State, to the point where many people locally in these areas refer to the process as the conflict process, not the peace process. And what I want to talk about today is reflecting a little bit on this question of why is it that during this period where there was so much kind of hope and aspiration of an attempt to resolve Myanmar's conflict, there has been a kind of increase in violent conflict. And in order to address this question, I really just want to make three points in the brief time that I have. Firstly, I very briefly want to provide some historical context to Myanmar's conflict and the sort of the ideologies that pervade the military's approach to addressing conflict in the country. Secondly, and perhaps most importantly, I want to reflect a little bit on how the past 20 years and the experiences of the ceasefires that were initiated in the late 1980s and 1990s have very much set the foundations for the current peace process and some of the limitations within it. And thirdly, drawing on this, I then want to provide a few reflections of perhaps my own take on what this means for where the current peace process is now. I don't have any time here to go into detailed historical context, but I just wanted to make a few brief points around the historical background of Myanmar's conflict. And the point that I really want to make is that the peace process as it is unfolding today, and as Martin mentioned, previous attempts throughout Myanmar's history, has to be placed in the broader context of the military's state-building approaches throughout the country, that the peace process is very much an adjunct to the broader efforts that the military sees in trying to consolidate control throughout the country. And I think in many ways the legacy of British colonialism in Burma created a powerful vision amongst the country's military elites of what it viewed as the need to be resilient, internally united, to overcome the threats that the country faced. Colonial rule, with its fixation on territory and kind of delineating the borders with what was then Siam and China, also created a powerful vision amongst central government elites of the desire to control large areas of the country that historically the Burmese monarchy had had kind of fluctuating control over. And yet the legacy of colonialism also provided very few foundations upon which to do so in terms of actual kind of administrative links between central Burma and a lot of what were known as the frontier areas. None of these issues were really resolved very effectively on the eve of the country's independence, and were substantially worsened under the military coup that took over the country in 1962, which installed a military elite that was very much fixated on securing unitary control over the country and a willingness to deploy violence in order to do this. And it was also built on a wider distrust of a population in many of these areas that it saw as not buying into its nationalist agenda of state building. And I think the legacy that this has created is, one, the willingness to deploy violence in the name of a higher cause of securing stability throughout the country. Secondly, a distrust of populations and an emphasis on the need to maintain surveillance and control throughout the country. And thirdly, an emphasis on the need to ensure compliance of what it sees as populations that it cannot trust. And I think all of these issues continue to pervade and underpin the military's approach to dealing with the peace process and has created very limited room for manoeuvre in some ways. The second point that I want to make is that the current peace process is very much built on the experiences of the ceasefire period since the late 1980s and early 1990s, where the military government signed an array of ceasefires with different armed groups throughout the country's borderlands. And as I see it, that experience over the last 20 years has really been driven by three different kind of experiences. The first is very pervasive militarization. The stability brought about by the ceasefires, the reduction in fighting, was seen as an opportunity by the military to extend its infrastructure throughout contested areas. And this isn't only through formal military, but also a whole array of army-backed militias through these areas as a way of trying to establish firmer control. The second experience was very much an attempt to increase resource extraction from borderland areas. This had a clear economic logic. By the late 1980s, the government's attempts at building the economy through prioritizing rice exportation from the delta had failed. The country was in a very parlous economic situation. And yet the growing interest, especially from China and Thailand, of natural resources throughout the country's borderlands, a willingness of the government to break away from the earlier economic policy, which had been much more kind of autarkic and inward-looking, led to an increased effort to try to extract resources from borderland areas as a way to kind of strengthen the national economy. And then the third aspect of this was very much a stalled peace process, where the ceasefires never really led to a more sustained peace process. In many ways, they gradually came to be seen as the continuation of war by other means, as the government tried to use the stability of these ceasefires to continue with its state-building agenda. And I think the big issue that came out of this is that you see the ceasefires of the late 1980s and 1990s as ultimately being underpinned by a major paradox, that the stability that they created, the reduction in levels of outright violent conflict in large areas of the borderlands, actually paved the way for highly destabilizing processes of extensive military buildup in these areas, rapid economic development, which was often done at the barrel of a gun in many ways, fairly coercively, through forms of land grabbing, through forms of forced resource extraction. So you have this tension that underpins the current peace process, that the stability of the past 20 years has actually been experienced very negatively by significant numbers in the population throughout borderland areas, and has been experienced through militarization, ongoing counterinsurgency efforts by the government to try and pick off weaker groups, efforts at exploiting the region's natural resources in ways that have been highly unsustainable, that have often pushed people off their land, and a willingness to use violence to discipline populations that have been adversely affected by these issues. And yet, from the military's perspective, in many ways, this period was a period of success from their own approach of militarized state building, in that the areas controlled by opposition groups has significantly weakened. The economic situation of the country is vastly better in 2010 than it was in 1988, not to mention the huge profits that individuals within the military and within the government have made from this process. So you have a period where actually the current peace process since 2010 has actually, I'll come back to that, has actually been built on very different perspectives and experiences of the ceasefire, that you have a growing sense of frustration, resentment amongst armed groups that sign ceasefires, amongst populations in these areas of many of, while they welcome the reduction in violence, it has also been associated with a huge number of other ills. And yet from the military's perspective, it's increasingly coming from a position of strength, where there is perhaps less willingness to feel the need to negotiate, the feeling that they're coming from having a much stronger position in borderland areas and a willingness to continue to push through a militarized state-building agenda. And I think this raises a number of issues that I just want to conclude on in this talk. That firstly, I think it requires us to think more carefully about Myanmar's transition, that some of the triumphalist rhetoric about the country finally coming into the light, realizing the error of its ways and kind of supporting a more kind of liberal market reform system, perhaps creates a very idealized vision of what this process of transition was actually about, and rarely reflects upon the reality of the foundations that it was built on and the actual kind of peace and kind of development that has been experienced in border areas. I think it also emphasizes very much the need to understand the foundations of Myanmar's military state, that in many of these areas, it is still the military that remains de facto in control. You may have a civilian government in Naypyidaw, you may have a parliamentary system, but if you look on the ground in a lot of these border areas, it is still the military that controls crucial ministries. It is still the armed forces that are the de facto power holders that determine, you know, people's ability to move through these areas, the decisions that are made around, you know, what NGOs can and can't do in these areas. And I think I haven't had time to go into this at all today, but it's something that I look at much more in my own work, is that also thinking about some of the ills and the problems within border areas, especially around continued violence, around militias, around drug addiction, and around the drug economy more broadly, is that these problems are not simply residuals of the conflict that have yet to be addressed. They're actually becoming deeply embedded in the kind of governance structures that are emerging throughout the country's borderlands. That, as I understand the ceasefire period over the last 20 years, and that is continuing into the current peace process, in many ways this is underwritten less by attempts to end violence necessarily. It's about an attempt to restructure who has the right to use violence, for what purposes and with what levels of impunity. That violence continues to be a major dynamic of who wins and who loses out of these processes, who gets rich, who doesn't. And I think there needs to be an awareness alongside the current peace process of the continuing role that violence is playing in ordering these areas. And this is something that also fits very much around the drug economy in these areas as well. That, again, in many ways, the drug economy is seen as a function of the war economy. It's seen as something that is financing the conflict. What that often overlooks is that deals made around the drug economy is also integral to the kind of deals that have been underpinning the ceasefire agreements and the stability in these areas. So the assumptions that the peace process, that development, however you define that, will necessarily bring an end to violence, to the drug issues in Burma, I think is not necessarily founded in the reality of the experiences over the last 20 years. And the final point that I want to bring on is that I think this challenges some of the kind of diffusionist narratives around peace processes, especially in countries like Myanmar, where you have a fairly strong central government, an array of subnational conflicts in border areas, that there's sometimes an assumption that the way that you get to peace and development in these areas is by integrating lagging areas, borderland areas, into the national economy, into the national polity. And there's a sense that you simply need to diffuse democratic structures, economic structures, into borderland areas. Whereas I think the point that I want to make is that a lot of the challenges within these areas are not because borderland areas have been left behind, that they are ungoverned spaces. It's precisely the way in which the military state has tried to govern these areas over the last 20 years that has embedded drugs, violence, in the way that these are now ordered, which creates huge challenges for how the peace process can actually address these issues, because there's an awful lot of vested interests around the structures that have emerged in these areas. I don't know what I did for time, but I'll finish there.
Thanks very much, Patrick. Okay, Jia Choi is the next speaker.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak in front of you. My name is Jia Choi Ban. I'm from northern Myanmar, and I'm now a student here at Anthropology Department. And today I'm going to share some of the insights of the and the new development happening inside the Kachin society in northern Myanmar. So I'm going to be talking about the alternative education movement, the emergence of alternative education movement in Kachin region after the resumed war of 2011. So first of all, I want to give a definition about alternative education. So in this for this case, I use alternative education as not mainstream, it is not a government-sanctioned education, it is localized, it is non-state, and it is also a public movement. And so before I talk about alternative education movement, I would like to first begin with the emergence of a new Kachin spheres. So in the wake of the resumed war between the Burmese military and a Kachin independent organization, which is the one of the most influential armed organization in Burma in 2011, the Kachin community home and abroad have consolidated and come to support the new Kachin agenda with a new sense of unity and thus the formation of new Kachin spare. So I would use this as a NKS as a abbreviation. So what is the scope of this new NKS, this new Kachin spare? The Kachin, so you can kind of think of it as a emerging communities, a concept from Benedict Anderson. So Kachin community all over the world, including overseas diaspora community, Kachin community across Myanmar, inside Myanmar, in northern Shan, in Mandalay, in Yangon, on all parts of Myanmar, and Kachin community and villages in liberated territory, which includes the KIO control territory. So this sense of this strong sense of solidarity inside the Kachin community across the war has emerged in the wake of the resumed war. So at the heart of the NKS, the kind of headquarter of the NKS is LISA, which is the headquarter of the Kachin independent organization. So what is happening inside this new Kachin sphere? So there is a there's a popular Kachin phrase called "bongam," I say, which means can no longer be together. So it is kind of a strong sentiment felt out of all this atrocity that the Kachin people are facing. They are being driven out of their homes. There's over 100,000 IDBs in Kachin and Northern Shan states, and because of because of all this atrocity, they have there's a strong sense of there's a strong sentiment of this anti-military, anti-state sentiment that is inside the Kachin's parent, which is kind of a driven force to become to form a new Kachin's pair. And so outside of the rhetoric of the Burmese state, so the Kachin newspaper in Kachin, this NKS is, one may say it is kind of a romantic spell that somebody make up, but actually it really exists. It's a sense of a, it's a kind of an imagined community. It really exists. It has the sense of resurgence of Kachinness and a renewed interest in Kachin languages, culture, and literature, and life and society. So this happened. And one of the examples being when I was in my undergrad college in Mandalay, when I started my college in Mandalay, like a lot of Kachin people, my peers, we are not very proud of, you know, being a Kachin at the time. So people are trying to like adopt the accent, like a Chinese accent, Chinese speaking Burmese or Burmese speaking Burmese accent. So trying to like get rid of our accent. So that happened, but and I'm very afraid to show off at the time. You know, you cannot show off your national flag, which is the flags of the Kachin independent organization. Now it's become a national flag. So it's the flag is, nobody is showing the flags, but nowadays there's these flags are everywhere. So this is the difference that I myself experience. And public become increasingly involved in political and social affair. So this is what is kind of a properties of these new Kachin pairs. So there's some major public movement happened inside the NKS agenda. The first one is the Partisan Drug and Eradication Social Movement, which is established in 2014. And the one that I'm going to be talking about, Kachin Immigration Reform, which is also can be called an alternative education movement. And I will be talking mainly on education. So education has become a major concern for the Kachin public. It is a national goal for the Kachin because there's a motto in Kachin, Pajigo antia lot lulam. So that means education as a mean for our freedom. So some people even say that Paji Sha, that means only education as a mean for our freedom. There's a problem with the state education system. Obviously, languages, history, and culture were being undermined. And also, there's a lot to talk about, you know, the failed education, the state education system. But I will be mostly focused on this new movement. This is Manaupol in Michina, Kachin State. This is a regular symbols of Kachin. This is where Kachin people dance around inside the Manaupol. That's a very dominant symbol of Kachin. And this is a new kind of Manaupol, which is called Paji Manau. Paji Manau means Paji Manaupol, which means knowledge. So just to let you know that, you know, Kachin, how Kachin people aspire to be educated and that kind of thing. And you can see that, and this is created by the theology education, theologian, Kachin theology education experts, let's see. And there's a lot of quotes from the Bible, and also there's a Kachin script, autography, you can see on the right. Yeah, this is a new, you know, the aspiration of Kachin in education. And Kachin education reform. What kind of agenda? What kind of program are there inside the Kachin education reform? It's the emergence of an education institution run by educated Kachin people. There's a basic education and higher education. They have a own some of the school have a own curriculum. So there's a Kachin curriculum reform project also going on. And there is a public, so this Kachin National Education Committee is also going on, which is a kind of an umbrella organization for all these education organization. And the significant things about this is public were very, very involved. So the members of the International Education Committee were from, they were not all from educated background. Some of them are the community leaders in the villages and various Kachin tribes. And there's also a Kachin Scholar Association. So these are the thing inside the education movement. And there's a Majayang. It's a town controlled by the GIO government, GIO Kachin Independent Organization. So it's a, and Majayang has become a hub of higher education. And it's also a part of GIO plans education, plan of the GIO Education Department. And a lot of the faculty members and teachers working in this this institution that I listed, Majayang Institute of Education, Institute of Liberal Arts and Sciences, Federal Law Academy, Majayang College. And they were, some of them were GIO a GIO civil servant, but a lot of them are coming from the city. They were not really a GIO civil servant, but a regular, you know, Kachin civilians. And this is a picture from a first grade class in taught by localized curriculum from a Kachin community in Lasho, Northern Chan State. Here you can see the, this is the day, the name of the days and name of the months in Jingpo language that we kind of lost that. So now they are trying to resurgence this kind of culture and literature into education. And this is the example of one of the organizations that were formed after 2011. This is a higher education organization school called Humanity Institute. And you can see an example of the subject that are now introducing to the Kachin young people through this education institution. And we have a Kachin Jingpo literature and language program, and we have a lots of arts and social sciences program. And this is Institute of Liberal Arts and Sciences in Majayang, one of the institute. And this is from First Kachin Scholar Association Conference in Majayang. And this is in Liza. This is this high school for IDV, high school especially built for the IDV students, built in 2016. And so they were built by the GIO Education Department. And this is the Federal Law Academy in Majayang. You can see the staff and regional officer of the GIO together. And this is from their website. And there's an Institute of Education in Majayang. And this is a building, Majayang College building, which is a building in progress going on. So education movement under the new Kachin spirit. So why does this education movement matter? Now, why does it matter? Because it is it is public movement, because it's matter. And another thing is that Kachin leaders are very much heavily involved in doing this kind of project. And another one is Kachin young educated people are involved. And introduction of social science education, because I found this quite important, because social science, as you know, as here in LSE, we all know it is to look for causes in society, to look for causes. So this is to look for causes and to ask questions, you know, to engage with debate and to introduce this kind of critical questioning tradition into the society. So this is kind of important. And so English language is to be to replace the Burmese language. A lot of the leaders have this sentiment to replace Burmese language. And this is mainly for knowledge sake. So by using English language, then we have more chance, we can open more doors into acquiring knowledge and education. And there are still some challenges, because many of these organized education institutions that I listed before were kind of directed and managed by young people who are kind of don't have a lot of experience. So there's organization and management expect, and there's also funding expect, And that challenge is that there's a government recognized certificate. There are a lot of these organizations are not recognized by government, obviously. So what they compensate for is by providing quality education. So even if you have the certificate from the government, it is not enough to get a job in Burma nowadays, because everybody knows that just mere degree certificate doesn't say anything about your quality, your ability. So what this institution are focusing on is to provide them a quality education, the skill that you can really apply in a real life, and the skill that employees are seeking for. So this is, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm trying to be brief. Maybe I just emphasize a bit what has been said and what, in my opinion, really is important as a takeaway, and also kind of things that we don't normally so much speak about. So Chatal Pan's talk just now, it's very important because she said quite so many things that I just want to emphasize here too. Chatoy was speaking about the strive for education as something that is a public movement, really. And what I want to really make here as a point, just a single point, is that these armed groups that we often think about as some form of organizations with a leader making some decisions, you know, over strategizing whether or not to go and negotiate with the government or go back into the trenches and all these kind of waves of conflict and peace that we do see in the country, that these are not decisions taken by one sort of overarching leader, but these are trajectories of movements that very much are the outcomes of various social pressures on these movements. And these pressures emerge particularly because these movements are deeply ontologically embedded within the societies that we speak about here. So this education thing here is hugely important, because obviously we see on the one hand that the KIO is building a federal law college. So really building, like bringing into existence a parallel legal institutional system. Yeah? But on the other hand, this is also about life worlds and social belief systems that, you know, a whole new generation of people have come to embody. So for instance, just this very one thing about, well, this KIO flag, yeah, some of you might know it, like red, green, two swords, used to be the flag, yeah, of the revolution, yeah? And now most young people see it as the Kachin land flag. Yeah? You can buy it, you know, to put on your smartphone, you know, on the back, for instance, with some fluffy ears even sometimes. So my argument really is just this one point now. Okay, these armed groups are inextricably linked and embedded in the society. And this, I'm picking up on the very interesting phrase here, the new Kachin sphere, creates a public sphere within which these armed groups need be understood. And that does impact on wider dynamics of peace and conflict in the country. Trying to make this argument brief here, just one thing maybe. So this is just all some photographs from actually Liza, the heart of this public sphere, as well as from Karen, which is in the east of the country. Yeah. But these are nurses here, for instance, yeah, or here on top, and Karen Education Department's training school for teachers. So these people, and this is not a new phenomenon, yeah, these people have been training their own teachers for their own parallel school system for many years. The thing then really, and this comes back to, I think, a very important notion here too, is, are these people insurgents? Well, they're not all kind of, you know, these gun-trotting rebels of our imaginations, right? These people are teachers. These people are students in a school that is being run by, for instance, the Karen National Union, which is, you know, one of the longest-standing ethnic armed groups in the country. And they don't make this decision to go to the school because, oh, it's better than the government school, or because they want to join the rebellion. But they make the decision often because this is where they're being located. But then these days often also because they do think, well, I want to learn my own language, for instance, rather than being ashamed of my accent, yeah, what we've just heard. What that creates, though, and all these are just a couple of examples. For instance, here, policemen of the Kachin independence organizations, this deep embeddedness. What this creates, though, is something that I think Martin Smith has still really described best in his work as insurgency as a way of life, conflict as a way of life. And this has not completely disappeared. Yeah, actually, it has re-emerged in some places of Myanmar, especially in the north. The problem then for the peace process is, and appreciating what also John and I think John pointed out here, that we do see a peace process that is a bit different, quite you know, fairly, that actually appreciates the need for some form of power sharing arrangements, federal systems in Myanmar. But the difficulty here still lies that it's a very elite-driven approach that basically brings together government negotiators with leaders from armed movements. So here, and this is a public letter by a couple of Karen civil society organizations, and it was written at the signing ceremony of the NCA, of the National Ceasefire Agreement, which is kind of anniversarying, if this word exists, in 2 days, and they were heavily criticizing the leaders of this armed movement, of their own ethnicity, so to speak, for signing this agreement, saying, well, all this is corruption, it's intransparent, and it goes against the majority decisions of the current population. Whether or not this is true, it's not for me to decide, but what I'm saying here, this public sphere creates certain pressures. And it's a bit of a deja vu, really, because if we think about the breakdown of the Kachin ceasefire, various many different things, yeah? I mean, of course, also pressures by the Takmador on the KO to transform into a border guard force under the direct control of the ethnic armed group. But also the kind of pressures from below on the KIO, where many, you know, different social forces have come together to put pressure on the KIO itself to change its approach that has been perceived as way, way too much going with state elites, also in cooperation with them with regards to what is known as ceasefire capitalism. What this creates then now, really, problematically is, and this is, for instance, here reflected by one of the chief negotiators of the group with the government, is that you have a street, you have a Kachin public that desires, actually, for independence, and we've just heard this, whereas the KIO still tries to negotiate some form of federal settlement, autonomy, within a federal union in the peace process. But that actually, as he's expressing here, that we as the KIO try to explain that we should be satisfied with these federal arrangements, but it's difficult for us to actually communicate this to the larger public. And just really briefly then, the conclusions of this or the implications of this, right? It poses a really important question when we think about these armed groups within societies, because it risks, like the whole peace process at the moment risks isolating certain leaders, as for instance in the case of the Karen National Union, General Mutu Sepo, who's now going to speak along Ming Aung Hlaing at the anniversary ceremony of the National Ceasefire Agreement, from the wider movements, actually. And it poses this question then about the kind of implementability of these settlements, of this leader coming back and actually, you know, quite frankly, just about like chains of commands also in the organization, of course, right? And what it does also point to is that within this kind of vehicle of the peace agreement, or peace process that we're having, that we need to address in combination with elite interests, these underlying identity needs of the population. And these are obviously being exacerbated at the moment when these populations are finding themselves in quite brutal counterinsurgency campaigns squeezed. And this is maybe just to end with. But thanks for really a great panel, actually. I enjoyed the different perspectives of state society here. And then some questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much then. As you can see, the complexity is really almost mind-boggling. For the students among you, I guess I can say there are many more dissertations here for you to write. Thank you very much for coming, and please join me in thanking our fantastic panelists.